You're listening to B2B Tech Talk, business-driven technology. Here's your host, Kimberly Durand.
Welcome to part two of my conversation with Phil Simon, a no BS trusted advisor for technology buyers. So let's talk about The New Small, which is your newest book, and that's all about smaller businesses using technology in amazing ways.
Sure. It's really about a way a new breed of small businesses is harnessing the power of emerging technologies. And it just was really interesting as I started to research these different companies. They were able to do some things just a lot simpler than the larger companies. They just didn't get in their own way.
Can you give us examples of what kinds of tools they're using?
Sure. In the book, I call them the five enablers, and there's a chapter that goes into some of these in some depth. But we're talking about software as a service, cloud computing, open source software, mobility, and social technologies. And by social technologies, I kind of group social media and social networks under them. So those are the five that I'm really focusing on. And, of course, the book has specific examples of how they're using Facebook or Rackspace or Firefox or WordPress, a lot of different tools out there under each category. I continued to work and read and do my thing in 2010, it was just obvious to me that small businesses were really struggling, trying to get their arms around all that's going on in the technology world right now. I mean, we live in a 24/7 news cycle with Facebook and Twitter and RSS feeds and texts, and there's just so much going on. And with a bad economy, many companies are still not sure about what to do with social media or mobility or cloud computing. So I wanted to write a book that would really focus on smaller businesses. According to the government, there are something like 30 million small businesses in this country. So that really is the target audience. I do believe that larger companies actually can learn something from their smaller brethren. They can learn maybe how to be more nimble and agile. The book really isn't anti-big company at all, but it really is in many ways sort of the antithesis of the first book, Why New Systems Fail, focused on system failures and implementations that went awry, and they were typically with larger companies. This book, aside from being able to use the real company names and profile some really dynamic folks, focuses on companies that are really doing the right things, but by the same token, and I was very careful selecting the companies that would comprise the new small, I didn't want companies that weren't willing to talk about lessons learned and mistakes. This isn't marketing literature. I really wanted, if people switched from, say, NetSuite to Salesforce.com, as one company did, I wanted them to talk about why. What did they learn from it? And I just thought it would be really important because, for all I know, there are other companies out there thinking of moving from System A or Technology A to Technology B. So I really wanted people who would talk candidly about the lessons, but it is very much a positive book.
Let's go back and talk more about the five enablers. So in your book, you say these are the five technologies that are really helping small businesses to make giant leaps. So you mentioned SaaS applications, cloud computing, open source software, social media, and mobility.
They're there for anybody. But there's something special about the companies that are really selecting them. So say with cloud computing, the benefit for this one law firm up in Minneapolis is that they actually lost a week and a half of work because their internal servers crashed. They just had so many documents. So in the case of this particular firm, they just threw everything up in the cloud. And some people said, you guys are crazy, this is risky, what about security? And they said, look, we know there are some risks, but there are also some major benefits. And now the cost savings and the downtime have really justified the investment. So while each case study might have a particular focus, in many instances the companies are using more than one of the five enablers. In fact, there are some companies that are basically using all of them. So they just have this really refreshing view on things. If something isn't working, they just find something that does work. It's amazing to me. I mean, there are just so many examples of, and in a way it's kind of obvious. But you say, okay, well, this wasn't working, so after 6 months they went with a new system. And some people who've always worked in small companies, they might say, well, why wouldn't you do that? But having worked in medium-sized and larger organizations, I can tell you that very rarely does that happen. There might be financial or legal or certainly political reasons that people stick with a technology that isn't working as well as it could because it works well enough. And one of the other pieces of the book and this is inspired by people like Seth Godin, who wrote the book Lynchpin, and if you work at a smaller company, particularly one that's using these technologies in interesting ways, you don't know what your job is going to be from day to day. You talk to some of these companies and you say, well, who's your head of IT? And they go, well, I don't know, I guess it's me today. So they don't really have these sort of rigidly defined roles or job descriptions. Every day is kind of an adventure. And really not everyone is cut out for that, but on a personal level, you know, I certainly am, and I really click with the owners of these companies and their employees, because there's just a certain kind of mentality that I think can have a lot of fun and do some really incredible things. But of course, your company and your culture have to allow it.
I love the idea of everybody in the organization being more actively involved in IT and helping to figure out what's working, what's not working.
Oh, absolutely. The Dataflux conference that we just spoke 2 weeks ago was certainly a recurrent theme. Many organizations still view data as IT's responsibility, and as someone who works very closely with IT, I can get the data out of the system, but you know, the lines of business actually created it. So whether you entered something into a CRM or an ERP system, you know, a lot of times IT gets the blame because they're the ones providing the, you know, the flat file or the Excel spreadsheet that has the information. Well, IT needs to clean this up. Well, you know, IT really didn't create it, so I just think that it's kind of an antiquated notion to view IT along those lines, and particularly if you've got software as a service or cloud computing, you know, IT no longer has to be the company responsible for, say, maintaining a Microsoft Exchange server if you're using Google Apps or Zoho or something along those lines. You don't need to do any of that. You know, many of these companies specifically said, we went in one direction because we don't really want to be responsible for maintaining our own hardware. We don't want to own, other than computers or iPads or iPhones, any real hardware. We'd rather run our business. And if that costs $7 or $10 a month, then so be it. So there's just, I think, a different mentality, not just in terms of IT management, but just general management.
On the one hand, a small business is more likely to look at IT as a utility company. If they access SaaS applications, that's something that they turn on and off like a light switch. And yet, on the other hand, they are more actively involved in IT on a daily basis.
Oh, at the smaller companies, absolutely. You don't find steering committees. You don't have six-year-long sales cycles like you might see at a large hospital, in which, you know, you're invariably coming down between one or two or three sort of major software vendors. You know, I learned, Kimberly, a tremendous amount just talking to these people, and I do know a decent amount about technology, but the tools that these people use, I was constantly scribbling down notes, and in the book there are plenty of end notes that actually detail all these technologies. And obviously, if you run a dental practice, you could care less about what a restaurant is running. But again, I really wanted to provide a lot of different options out there that would really transcend industries. So what are your options for productivity suites? Well, you don't just have to use Microsoft Office, although it's a fine tool. You can use OpenOffice. You can use Google Docs. You can use Zoho. So find something out there that really works for your organization or is more cost-effective or whatever your criteria would be. The amount of software choice, which is something that I address in the book, has for some people been quite dizzying, but for other people, again, there's just this tremendous opportunity out there. You know, no longer is an organization really stuck between, you know, running Windows or running some sort of old school, you know, green screen-based GUI. You've got different operating systems out there. I just bought a Macintosh a couple weeks ago. You know, Google's doing a lot of things with Android. I hear Google's coming out soon with its own hardware, own laptop. So there's just a lot going on right now, and there really is no one right answer. You know, for a particular small business, there may be something that just works for them, and that's fine. You know, one of the companies in the book uses Microsoft Online Services, which is Microsoft's small business offering. They specifically want to be a Microsoft shop. They love Outlook. They love the calendar. They love SharePoint. That's fine. That works for them. And there are other companies that would never go in that direction because they know that there are open source equivalents and they'd rather play with their own versions of them. So again, it's not that there's a right or wrong. It's just that there's a ton of information out there, and if you are inclined, you can really get a lot of bang for the buck.
It's inspiring to see smaller, agile businesses using these tools in smart ways.
Oh, absolutely. It's funny. The people who really founded and run these companies are just incredibly dynamic folks. I'll just give away one little teaser from the last chapter of the book. I'm a big tennis player, and I was reading Andre Agassi's book, Open. And at the end of the book, he's about to ask out Steffi Graf. He'd just been divorced from Brooke Shields. And he winds up talking to his friend and says, I need a pep talk. And his friend JP says, okay, here's the pep talk, and I promise I'm going somewhere with this. So there are two types of people in this world. Thermostats and thermometers. Others register the temperature in the room. You're a thermostat, you raise it. And I literally, Kimberly, stopped what I was doing, went downstairs, and with attribution, put that in the book, because these founders of these companies are very much thermostats. They raise the temperature. They're just really inspiring, dedicated people. Talking to these people was a lot like they're talking about their children. They built these companies from the ground up, and they were really dedicated to building a great company. They weren't really focused on getting big at all costs. They really wanted to avoid the mistakes that some of the larger companies had made. And that isn't just with regard to technology, because that's a big part of the book. It's actually with regard to, say, HR or people management or whatever you want to call it. So the book, in a way, for me, is an interesting mix. I've got this sort of technology background, but I've got this sort of, you know, HR or employee relations type background, and I thought it was important to meld the two, because much like the first book and the second book, it really does all hinge upon people. Anyone can go out there and purchase software as a service kind of solution or download open source software, but there's something special about these companies that's really allowing them to do so much with these emerging technologies, and I really wanted to focus on the companies. I think that these technologies don't implement themselves. So The people management piece is really a big part of the book.
You also talk about the major trends affecting small business right now.
Sure, there's a bunch. I mean, we talked about the explosion of software choice. Another big one is the freemium model, a free open source software. If you read a book like Chris Anderson's Free, The Future of a Radical Price, he really lays out that, you know, the distribution costs are basically zero. Right, so you can sign up for Salesforce.com and access limited functionality for free. Right, this isn't 1995 when you had to send away for an AOL disk, right, and you'd install the CD. So with broadband and with increased storage, there's a lot of, I think, flexibility now. Organizations can try out a tool like, say, Yammer, which is kind of like Twitter for the workplace, and see if it works. And if it doesn't work, then you don't have to use it. There isn't the same sort of cost investment. So one of the big ones is really free and open source software. And there are other sort of non-technology trends that I discuss in the book. I think that we've definitely entered a better period of outsourcing. For example, one of the companies, Peerport, which develops collaboration software, found some very promising developers over in India. And many companies have really struggled with outsourcing. But now I think that we've got better collaboration tools, and some things have sort of shaken out a little bit. It's a lot easier to use people you've never met. There's a company, Fuentech, that I profile in the book. It's a completely virtual company. The head of the company, Laura Schopp, who actually went to Carnegie Mellon, although not when I was there, I did a podcast with her on my website a couple of months ago. That's how we know each other. She hasn't even met some of her employees. They're totally virtual. And that's not as weird now as it would have been 10 or 15 years ago. So with these collaboration tools and all the different things out there, and just sort of a different management ethos with some of these companies, there really is this sort of environment more conducive to doing cool things with technologies and saving money and, you know, increasing awareness and all the other benefits. I mean, I make the points in the book that you're not just going to the clouds or using social networks for the sake of doing so. There really is a business reason behind it. And that's, I think, something that people maybe in big companies don't appreciate. They say, well, you know, it ain't broke, don't fix it. In a lot of organizations is still the norm. And, you know, there's this classic book by this guy Christensen called The Innovator's Dilemma. And it's very difficult for these big companies to kind of get out of their own way. How do they cannibalize their business models when those models have made them so successful? So they become complacent. And if you read a book like Jim Collins' How the Mighty Fall, which I discuss a little bit in the second book, you know, these companies sort of reach a point of decay and there's really no going back. These smaller companies never want to get to that point, so they're constantly asking themselves, is this the best way? And that even sort of filters down to when they hire employees. A lot of these companies will ask new hires flat out, okay, what kind of tools do you use? What don't we know about? Contrast that with big companies and say, okay, well, this is what you have to use for email, and this is what you have to use for whatever. So it's a lot more democratic in these smaller companies, which is something that, again, I talk about in the book.
Yeah, I guess if anything, bigger businesses just have to be so protective and so careful about things getting out of control. So they're just trying to keep Twitter contained and social media contained.
Oh, it's so funny. You hear some people from bigger companies say, oh, sure, we do social media because we've got a Facebook page or a Twitter account, as if you can just check that box, but they don't really produce any meaningful content. And conversely, when employees want to go there, their WebSense prevents them from going to Facebook or Twitter or LinkedIn. So don't even get me started on social media. I think that it's we are very much in the early innings of social media, but it's obvious to me that, you know, there's one guy in the book, Chef Tony, he runs a restaurant down in Maryland. And the way this guy uses social media to build his brand and to get customers into his restaurant is absolutely amazing. He's probably the best example in the book of effectively using social media. People literally go into his restaurant, never having met him, and just go, hey, Tony, because they feel like they know him because of his videos and his blog posts and his tweets. And he just cultivates such a warm feeling with his customers. I just don't see how sort of traditional marketing can really imbue that kind of feeling.
Interesting. So are you going to tell us the secrets of how he got started with that and brought it to that level?
He's always been, he can speak for this better himself, but he's got one of my favorite quotes in the book. He's sort of a geek. He's always been a geek, which he says in a flattering way, but his quote is, there are two parts of my brain, food and technology, and I'm constantly thinking about how you fuse the two together. And I just, the second he said that, I just said, I love that. So he's thinking about, you know, constantly when he's cooking, all right, how can I film a video, for example, of, say, cooking fish, because other people, even though they may not live anywhere near Maryland, right, maybe they're in, you know, Australia or something, and their cousin's going to Maryland or something. So he realizes, I think, what a lot of other small businesses do with regard to social media. It's much better to have a recommendation when someone says, hey, you know, Kimberly, I know we have the same sort of tastes. Why don't you check out this restaurant or check out this book or this band or whatever? Mm-hmm. That's a lot better than being spammed with, right, some, you know, email campaign. So it's funny because in a way it can be more effective, but it's a lot more time consuming. You can't just spend, you know, $5,000 on social media and expect the same results. I think about my own sort of personal social media efforts and the way I was able to raise, you know, almost $5,000 in pre-sales for the book since I started a publishing company to do this. And it's not something that I could have done 2 years ago, but I've spent a lot of time reading other people's blogs, commenting, retweeting their stuff, making friends with them, picking up the phone, calling them. So a lot of my social capital has really paid off. So it's I think I'm a case in point about being a very small business. I'm a business of one, of ways to effectively use this to reach your audience.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I do hear a lot of people saying they're still confused about how social media can actually contribute to their revenue. But if you do your research, there's a lot of people who are using social media in very smart, strategic ways, not just sending out tweets every now and then. It's actually strategic. It can make a difference for your business.
It's funny. One of the things that I mentioned in the book is going to my local tennis store. I'd broken a racket and was just talking to someone at the counter, and they know that I'm a big technology guy. And the woman, her name is Linda, said to me, yeah, Phil, I'm not sure if we need a Facebook page or a website. And I'm just thinking, why not both? You know, and they do have a Facebook page, but, you know, why can't I find you on just the web? You know, do you think that it's that difficult or expensive? Because, you know, I've got a great web developer who's done amazing work for me, and she's not terribly expensive at all. So it's funny because there are still some small businesses sort of stuck in the Stone Ages. They question whether or not they even need a website, and you say, well, who really questions that anymore? It's like having a telephone. But even if you look at a lot of websites, they don't tend to be very content-laden. In the book, I call them 90 sites, right? You've got five pages, right? Home, about, services, contact, and maybe one other page. But, you know, as Chris Brogan, the guy who's writing the foreword, says, you don't watch TV for the commercials. You don't read magazines for the advertisements. You want content. So if your sites don't have content, then why are you coming back? And I can tell you that I actually, you know, I can't give you my specific ROI on social media, but I have picked up clients before because they read my blog or they read one of my books and said, wow, this guy can really help us. So I don't really blog about the 10 reasons you should hire me. Hopefully I'm making a general point. And most sort of well-written blogs don't do that, but in many companies they either don't blog or their blogs are sort of thinly veiled marketing attempts, which most people don't read, which sort of reinforces this notion, oh, well, social media isn't effective. Well, it's not effective because you're not doing it well or you're not doing it often enough. So it's
that
not
is a
really,
big, big problem.
Yeah, but it's time-consuming. I mean, I can tell you I spend a tremendous amount of time, you know, blogging and reading and on the social networks, particularly when I'm not at a client site. And, you know, some people might say, well, you're wasting your time. And you know what? I can't argue with them. You know, if you don't see the value in it, then You know, it's like religion. I'm not going to try to convince you. But for the companies that do get it and they do have this sort of social media religion, I really do think that the results speak for themselves.
I want to hear your insights on people and technology. So how much can companies really fix their problems by purchasing new tools? And how much of their problem is to do with the management of people and those tools?
I've said this before. I would rather have just a simple Microsoft Access database that had accurate information than a world-class, best-of-breed system that was rife with nonsense and people who didn't know how to use it. I think that in many cases, software vendors and consultants like me are demonized because maybe we make promises that we shouldn't make, but by the same token, clients kind of hear what they want to hear. If your organization has a bunch of problems, then wouldn't it be great if you could spend $1 million on Oracle or SAP and then all your problems go away? It's just not that simple. I do think that there are absolutely limits to what you can do with what I call Enterprise 1.0 technologies. There are tremendous benefits of clouds and SaaS and open source and mobility and all those technologies. But I think that it's really sort of fallacious to just expect your software vendor to solve all your problems. There's a saying in my field, GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. Well, that applies whether it's a 40-year-old mainframe system or a thin client web-based, SaaS-based system and everything in between. So certain tenets really haven't changed, even though the technologies obviously have.
Let's talk about some of the cues that bigger businesses can take from what small businesses are doing right now.
Oh, gosh. I'll try to answer that question quickly. I don't see what's wrong with admitting failure. You implemented a system and it didn't work. You know, get away from it. Politically, it can be difficult, and it's a lot easier said than done, and certainly financially you have a vested interest in it and seeing it succeed. But if something isn't working, you have to think about whether or not that's the right technology. The other thing that I'll say is, and this is different really for legal reasons, this is where my sort of background in labor relations comes into play. You know, bigger companies are subject to many more laws and much more legislation. So smaller companies, for example, don't really have to deal with, just as an example, Family Medical and Leave Act. I think the threshold is 50 employees. Well, small companies still will give their employees leave, but they're not encumbered by as many legislations. So it's obviously a lot more difficult in a bigger company because you don't have to you have to deal with, say, discrimination laws or OSHA or some of those things. But in a smaller company, if someone's not working out, you basically get rid of that person. Mm-hmm. I think we've all seen bigger companies that have had people who were really just dead weight. Really hurting morale and hurting the company. And if you've got 50,000 employees and, say, 10 bad apples, that's really a low percentage. Well, if you've got a small company of, say, 10 employees and one bad apple, well, that's 10% of your workforce. Now, it's a lot more difficult, I think, to hide at a smaller company because you can't say, oh, I thought this department was going to do it because there really aren't as many departments or people. But I really do think, and maybe this is just me being sort of a black and white systems guy, that if an employee isn't working out, I mean, look, you're running a business. You're not running a charity. So you can work with that person, maybe find the appropriate role, but at a smaller company, you'll see these people just really find the people who work and pay a premium for them. Many times as a consultant, people will try to get me for a rate that I just won't work for.
Mm-hmm.
So they wind up finding somebody who's less per hour, but that person winds up taking 6 months on something and it would have taken me three. So the bigger companies, I think, can focus on, well, this is my budget, and they don't really look long-term. The smaller companies, I'm finding, are able to look long-term a bit more. The bigger companies, particularly the publicly traded ones, really do have to worry about quarterly earnings and bonuses and things like that. Well, if you're owning the company, this goes back to what I was saying before with agency theory, there aren't as many different players with different goals. So people are much more aligned, and if you've got an employee who isn't helping or is in fact hurting, then that person goes and you find somebody else. Most of these companies would rather not have a position filled than have a position filled with the wrong person.
Tell us about your podcast. It's called Technology Today, and what do you cover on there?
I've done podcasts on business intelligence or master data management, social media, blogging.
And is it for a business audience or technology people?
I try to make it for both. You know, certain topics aren't going to appeal to certain people. I understand that you're never going to make everybody happy. But I'm the host. I do a lot less talking than I'm doing now. And I'll find somebody to talk about, you know, open source software. Or I think at one point, I think my next one's going to be with a woman named Sue Collier about the publishing industry. And it's up on iTunes.
Well, Phil, I am so thrilled that you could be with us, and I sought you out specifically because I see you as an excellent, trusted advisor for technology buyers. Thank you so much.
Well, I appreciate you having me, Kimberly.
Tell us what you think about business-driven technology and what tools and technologies are critical for growing companies today. Email me at talk@b2btechtalk.com.
You've been listening to B2B Tech Talk. Visit our website at www.b2btechtalk.com.